One miscalculation, the world faces nuclear annihilation. The head of the UN warns we're at the most dangerous time since the Cold War. Nuclear-armed nations are calling for disarmament, but do they have the will to eliminate nuclear weapons? This is Inside Story. Hello, welcome to the program. I'm Kim Vanell. The Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons has been credited with keeping the world safe. Nearly every country has signed the agreement, known as the NPT, which aims to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons and promote the peaceful use of atomic technology. But the UN Secretary-General warns the world is just one dangerous miscalculation away from nuclear conflict. Antonio Guterres says the threat is at its highest level since the end of the Cold War. Russia's invasion of Ukraine has dramatically raised the stakes. There are concerns about China's rapid uptake of nuclear weapons. The UN is hosting a conference to review ways to strengthen the treaty. But some nations believed to hold nuclear weapons, including Israel, India and Pakistan, are not attending. We'll bring in our guests in a moment, but first, this report from Kristen Salumi at UN headquarters in New York.
The UN Secretary General kicked off the 10th review conference of the NPT by sounding the alarm.
Today, humanity is just one misunderstanding, one miscalculation away from nuclear annihilation. We have been extraordinarily lucky so far, but luck is not a strategy.
His pessimism stands in sharp contrast to when Russia and the United States signed on to the treaty in 1970.
This is indeed an historic occasion.
It was the height of the Cold War, and the goal was to prevent a nuclear conflict.
Nations of the world moved from a period of confrontation to a period of negotiation and a period of lasting peace.
As recently as January, the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, who also happen to be the officially recognized nuclear weapons states, the United States, the United Kingdom, Russia, China, and France, all pledged not to further disseminate nuclear weapons. But
a month later, Russia invaded Ukraine. While Russia claims full compliance with the NPT, others consider that a threat.
And it's engaged in reckless, dangerous nuclear saber-rattling, with its president warning that those supporting Ukraine's self-defense, quote, risk consequences such as you have never seen in your entire history.
And then there's the Iran nuclear deal, agreed in 2015. It was heralded as a step toward reducing proliferation until the U.S. withdrew. Now Iran says it has enough uranium to build a nuclear weapon. While few nations have gone as far as North Korea in trying to build them, anti-nuclear campaigners say other countries are expressing a new willingness to host them as a deterrent. That's what frightens Valeria Hess, a nuclear expert from Ukraine attending the conference.
So there is a widespread belief that nuclear weapons have prevented a big war. And it turned out not to be true.
Signatories to the NPT are meant to gather every 5 years in an attempt to advance the goal of disarmament. This year, thanks to global tensions, experts say there's little hope of action. Kristen Salumi, Al Jazeera, the United Nations.
Well, the head of Iran's atomic agency says his country has the ability to make a nuclear bomb, but doesn't plan to. An advisor to Iran's supreme leader made similar comments to Al Jazeera last month.
It's no secret that we have become a nuclear threshold state, and this is a reality. It's also no secret that we have the technical capabilities required to manufacture a nuclear bomb. But we don't want that.
Global watchdogs say despite a small decrease in the number of warheads last year, the total nuclear arsenal is expected to grow in the next decade. Just 9 countries hold the world's estimated stockpile of 12,700 nuclear warheads. More than 90% of them belong to Russia and the US. The two nations have been jointly retiring their arsenal, getting rid of a total of 3,660 warheads. But many still remain. The U.S. has been scaling back its non-strategic nuclear weapons, which are shorter in range and have less explosive force, while Russia has largely kept its stockpile. Let's bring in our guests in Vienna, Robert Kelly, a distinguished fellow at the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. He's also a former director at the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency. In Lahore, Rabia Akhtar, director at the Center for Security and Policy Research at the University of Lahore and author of the book The Blind Eye, U.S. Non-Proliferation Policy Towards Pakistan from Ford to Clinton. And in Washington, Richard Cupid, a senior fellow and director at Partnerships and Proliferation Prevention at the Stimson Center. He's previously worked for the State Department on counterproliferation. A very warm welcome to you all. I'd like to start with you, Robert Kelly. Antonio Guterres says he's worried that crises with nuclear undertones could escalate. How serious is the threat right now that nuclear weapons could actually be used?
I don't see it very large between the designated nuclear weapon states, the permanent five. I would be very concerned about South Asia and India and Pakistan maybe losing some of their reserve to not use nuclear weapons. The concerns in Ukraine right now are probably real, but I don't see them as rising to a very high level right now.
Okay. Richard Cupid, this U.S. Secretary of State gave a big speech about how invested the U.S. is in lowering the threat of nuclear war. But do the main nuclear powers that we've talked about, do they actually want nuclear weapons eliminated, or do they just want to stop others from having them?
Well, thank you for the invitation. I certainly believe there's an interest, at least in the part of the Biden administration, which you can see in President Biden's statements for the NPT, at reducing the U.S. nuclear arsenal. But I think the question has always been how to do that without actually increasing the risk of nuclear conflicts in the process. I'm not so sure about some of the other nuclear powers at this point, particularly given the Russian Federation's, as you've noticed, noted in your report, its references to nuclear weapons and its current recent unprovoked threats. And there may be other countries that also have limited interest in nuclear disarmament at this time. Mm. For me, I am with, though, Undersecretary, UN Secretary General Guterres, is we're a miscalculation away. I would point and side with Professor Scott Sagan in believing that the more states with nuclear weapons, the greater the risk of accident, theft, sabotage, or miscalculation. So I think there is it's not necessarily a hypocritical position to be in to want to try to reduce your weapons stockpiles while preserving and making sure that you increase the risk of use of nuclear weapons in the process. So thanks.
Okay, Rabia Akhtar in Lahore, you see the non-proliferation treaty as a sort of gatekeeper with these main players. Can you just walk us through that?
Thank you so much for having me on the show. I've always maintained this position that international non-proliferation regime, you know, can be best categorized as organized hypocrisy. And we all believe that organized hypocrisy is an inherent part of the complex international system where a state's behavior is inconsistent with the norms and principles it rhetorically endorses. And the international system, we all understand, is unpredictable and complex. And the rules and norms of the system, they constantly clash with the state's national interest, making it difficult to remain consistent in its behavior. So one would argue that if these inconsistencies in behavior exist, then new norms should be established. But we have seen that over the past several decades, no new norms have been established to deal with these inconsistencies. And I believe that, you know, this organized hypocrisy has been a development of popular narratives, and there has been selective norms of non-proliferation that have been projected in order to serve purposes. And we have, there are plenty of examples, you know, that lead us to believe that it is in the interest of countries like U.S. and others, other allies of the U.S., to pick and choose countries that benefit from the selective proliferation.
Can you give us some examples?
Therefore, in the interest of U.S. Yeah. So, for example, you know, when in 2013, U.S. was negotiating with Iran in order to stop its nuclear weapons program, or not having the ambitions to develop nuclear weapons, it was signing a nuclear cooperation agreement with Vietnam, and it decided that it is going to provide, you know, heavy fuel for, you know, Vietnamese reactors. And Vietnam at that point in time also had a very dismal human rights record. There was no regime for nuclear security in place, yet this selective case of proliferation was happening, while on the other hand, Iran was denied the same.
Mm. I want to throw it over to Robert Kelly to get your take on that. Is this organized hypocrisy by some of those main powers? I'm thinking about AUKUS, the deal between the US, Australia and the UK to let Australia get nuclear-powered submarines, which China is obviously very concerned about. You know, is there some hypocrisy going on?
There's major hypocrisy there, and I think giving this over to lawyers and accountants has shown they're easy to get the wrong end of the stick. The problem right now is that Australia has six small diesel submarines that they use for coastal defense, and somewhere the French offered them replacements for those same machines. What has happened is the U.S. and the U.K. waded in, stabbed the French in the back, and convinced the Australians that they need eight nuclear submarines that are capable of launching missiles at the Chinese mainland from the South China Sea. That's the big problem. They're not nuclear missiles they want to launch, but land attack missiles. Australia has turned its entire program upside down from coastal defense to attacking China. And if you don't think that's going to cause problems, just watch what's happening with China. Mm. They see it as a major threat. And to the earlier comment, I would like to say that Russia has made some very threatening comments. Donald Trump made the same comments about his red button a couple of years ago and the hell that he would rain down on North Korea. So a lot of people can make big talk, but let's see if they really mean it.
Just before we move on, Mr. Kelly, from you talked there about, you know, Russia. I guess it's been accused of nuclear saber rattling. But then at the beginning of this conference, these talks happening, President Putin wrote, "We proceed from the fact that there can be no winners in a nuclear war and it should never be unleashed." So is that really nuclear saber rattling, or is Russia opening up the door for discussions?
I think what we're missing here is there are several different scenarios we should be looking at. There's the bilateral problem between mostly the Americans and the Russians, who've dealt with it for decades with arms control. And then there are larger issues of the Perm 5, and there are larger issues yet of the Perm 5 plus the states that have nuclear weapons but are not part of the NPT. Where you put North Korea in that is difficult to say. So I think what we're thinking here is the bilateral issue between Russia and the United States. Yeah, there is danger there, but it's complicated by NATO, of course, because the other NATO members are nuclear umbrella states. But that, I think, is where we might be concentrating right now.
Mm. Richard Cupid in Washington, D.C., how has the war in Ukraine changed the calculation around warfare and around nuclear weapons and around nuclear deterrence?
Well, I think that's the impact is still to be determined, but the immediate situation is, I think it's hardened some positions in terms of those who are supporting the Ban Treaty, for example. But at the same time, it has moved some other states that had not been in prior years supportive of, let's say, an extended nuclear umbrella, mainly Sweden and Finland, towards NATO, which I think Russia did not really anticipate or hope would happen as a result of the second invasion of Ukraine. So I certainly think it does have some additional impacts. Having worked at the United Nations as well as State Department, I think it's going to be very difficult for U.S. diplomats to trust their counterparts on the other side, given what's been said. In addition, I think another thing that's another development is, though, there may be some more serious discussion of the safety and security of nuclear power plants, which, given what's happened in Ukraine, and the seven pillars idea that's been endorsed by the Board of Governors, that came from Director General Grossi. I think those that's a discussion that needs to be moved to the forefront, because we're, especially as we see an increase in interest in nuclear power around the world in order to address some of the issues related to climate change.
I want to come back to you, Rabia Akhtar, to talk a little bit more about this idea of hypocrisy, because when we talk about the main nuclear powers, the US, UK, Russia, China, France, what about the other suspected nuclear powers, Israel, India, Pakistan? Why is it okay for them, I guess, US allies, to have these weapons, but not their adversaries, say, Iran?
I think that's a great question. And it's also, you know, to deal with the gatekeeping and the kind of power they have by dividing the world into haves and have-nots. And even, you know, with Israel, India, and Pakistan that are outside the NPT and have nuclear weapons are considered to be illegitimate nuclear weapon states. They are called nuclear armed states and nuclear possessor states, but not nuclear weapon states. So even with the lexicon, you know, you try to control power and to what it means to these countries. I believe that, you know, countries like Israel, for example, there's hardly any conference that I have attended on nuclear weapons in which, you know, Israel is invisible. Nobody talks about Israel's nuclear weapons. Nobody talks about, you know, what is stopping the Middle East from achieving a nuclear weapon-free zone. Well, all the other countries are on board except for Israel, and the United States is backing it. And also with this idea that, you know, one country possessing nuclear weapon has a different sense of rationality as compared to the P5 who have nuclear weapons, as if, you know, they will be more rational with their use of nuclear weapons. And these illegitimate countries outside the club will be irrational.
Where do you think that stems from? Where do you think that stems from, this idea that, you know, the P5 would take rational decisions and, you know, other nations would not? Where does that come from?
So it has always been, you know, a part of the broader security studies, strategic studies literature, where, you know, United States being the first country to acquire it, generated this narrative that, you know, we are the ones more responsible with nuclear weapons, and any other new state, you know, is not going to be responsible. So this whole idea about nuclear responsibility somehow has been engineered. And now, you know, over a period of decades, it has come to this blame game sort of a thing with respect to nuclear weapons and responsibility. That, you know, I think it needs a new narrative. It needs new generation to take this forward and question as to how are you most responsible when you are the ones who, the only country in this world who have used nuclear weapons, only country in the world who has had more number of accidents leading, if those accidents, you know, actually detonated, you know, the world would have seen those, you know, weapons detonated. You have had decades of nuclear learning, and these new nuclear countries have looked at you and your accidents and the history of it and have learned that, you know, what is not to be done and are more, you know, responsible with their nuclear safety and security regime. Mm-hmm. Yet we are the ones, you know, who are pointed fingers at. I think all of this needs to be questioned and continuously being questioned, that one rationality, you know, is not superior to the others.
I just want to pass it over to Robert Kelly. Was there something you wanted to add to that?
I think the first reason that one believes that there's some rationality in the weapons possessing states is about 75 years of restraint and not using them. If we look at the introduction that you gave, someone said the large countries are down about 3,000 weapons. I think they're more like 30,000 weapons have been removed from the Russian and American stockpiles. And if we look at what countries are growing their stockpiles today, the largest growth is in Pakistan. Pakistan will surpass the United Kingdom and France fairly soon in being about the fourth largest weapons state, no matter what kind of a label you put on them. So if you're worried about who's increasing their stockpiles and who is behaving militaristically, I'd start with Pakistan and India, followed shortly by DPRK.
Yeah, I want to talk about North Korea, because you can't really have a discussion about nuclear non-proliferation without talking about North Korea. How does the DPRK keeping nuclear weapons on the table, showing them off, launching tests, how does that impact other nations and their ability or inability to reduce their stockpile? Because if you have that, you know, clear threat on display, what does it do for the rest of the non-proliferation disarmament movement? And also, what does it mean for South Korea?
I think one of the first things you have to look at is whether the North Korean stockpile is real or not. They have tested a number of weapons. Most of those tests, we can follow through their lineage and see what they were for. I don't think their thermonuclear test was real in the sense of being a weaponizable device. And there's no sign that those warheads have ever been fitted to a missile and tested to see if they reach a target. So DPRK may be accumulating weapons, but they're not accumulating weapon systems that can deliver a weapon to a target.
Okay. Richard Cupid, how has the fight against climate change complicated efforts toward denuclearization? Because obviously energy is becoming more expensive. People are looking back towards nuclear options. So how is that kind of coloring the picture?
Well, certainly, I think a number of states have indicated that their real interest in expanding their nuclear power programs or embarking on a nuclear power program in the light of climate change, especially with small modular reactors, other new and advanced reactor systems. In terms of denuclearization, that's an issue. In terms of getting rid of nuclear weapons or preventing proliferation, it's more of an issue of over time. I think we've known from the beginning that if you learn a few things from nuclear power, they do have some application to developing programs. So the issue has always been how do we promote the peaceful uses, including nuclear power, of nuclear energy, while restraining any idea of moving towards a weapon system. And that's largely through safeguards, and comprehensive safeguards agreements, which is what the IAEA and the United and international community has relied on in the past. It does complicate things because it creates more states that will be in a position, if they so choose, to pursue a nuclear weapons program. That's a big if. Mm-hmm. Moving from being able to do it to choosing to do it is a very big step. I think there's a really interesting book recently by Vipram Narang called Seeking the Bomb, that talks about hedging strategies. A number of states have moved to a point where they might be able to have a program, but they've so far chosen not to. Some others have actually maybe have more of a chosen to do so, but not tested, not moved beyond that. So there's a range of strategies related here. But I think the most important one is for states to be able to enjoy the peaceful uses of nuclear energy and nuclear technologies, but making sure that they don't choose to pursue a nuclear weapons program.
Sure. Okay, we're coming.
I would note, part of our nuclear cooperation agreements is to push that, uses.
I hear what you're saying. We're coming to the end of the program. We've got about 45 seconds left, so it's a very quick question to you, Rabia Akhtar. Is the promise of nuclear non-proliferation essentially unfair because it keeps the power in the hands of those countries that can exploit them?
I think we have much to be grateful for to the NPT that it has kept the numbers low. But I do believe that this bargain is unfair. And even with this current REFCON, you would see that Russia and the threats that it has made is going to dominate. And it's again going to come back to that circular argument that you can't disarm, P5 cannot disarm, because there is not broader peace and international security. If you would just allow me a couple of seconds to, I'd raise my hand to make a comment about South Asia being the nuclear flashpoint, and both of my panelists have, referred to it. 2019 Pulwama Balakot crisis between India and Pakistan, crisis termination squarely rested with Pakistan, which did not use a nuclear N-word in the entire crisis. And the whole literature coming out from the West says that Pakistan will be the one to use nuclear weapons. So I think there is a change of narrative that needs to be brought about. We appreciate non-use coming from the West, but they don't squarely have the ownership of non-use. New countries like India, Pakistan, you know, have restrained from using nuclear weapons. And through several crises, there's much evidence to it.
Okay. We will have to leave it there for time. Thank you very much to all of our guests, Robert Kelly, Rabia Akhtar and Richard Cupid. And thank you too for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. We are @AJInsideStory. From me, Kim Vanel, and the whole team here in Doha. Bye-bye for now.